From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Then she said, "Are you anti-American?" And I said, "What? Are you anti-American? What does it mean?" I said, I am against, for instance, the American policy in war. Is this being anti-American?"
A Democracy Now! Exclusive. A respected Greek professor is detained, shackled, and questioned at Kennedy Airport when he flies in for a conference at New York University. The story has made headlines in Greece, but has not been reported here. Then Noam Chomsky talks about confronting empire.
The most powerful state in world history has proclaimed loud and clear that it intends to rule the world by force.
All that and more coming up. You are listening to Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. Turkey is demanding the U.S. allows them to place up to 80,000 troops deep inside Iraq in a case of war. This according to an exclusive report in Newsweek. It comes as Turkey and the United States are negotiating whether the U.S. can use Turkish land to stage an attack on Iraq. Turkey is also seeking $30 billion in aid from the United States and permission to take over portions of northern Iraq. Yesterday, the Turkish president said his country will only allow U.S. soldiers to use Turkey to attack Iraq if the U.N. passes a second resolution authorizing the use of force against Iraq. Although 95% of the Turkish population opposes war in Iraq, the government has expressed willingness to help the United States. European Union leaders have agreed to a declaration demanding Iraqi President Saddam Hussein disarm immediately. They also declared that war with Iraq is a last resort. The Washington Post is reporting that George Bush plans to spend just two more weeks of diplomacy before deciding whether to attack Iraq. North Korea has threatened to pull out of the armistice agreement that ended the Korean War. Accusing the United States of breaking the terms of agreement by bolstering its forces in the region and mounting a naval blockade. This comes as the U.S. and South Korea announced they'll stage joint military exercises in South Korea next month. The Pentagon has ordered a review of how the Air Force Academy handles sexual assault allegations after five female cadets said they were reprimanded and treated like they were crazy for reporting they were raped by classmates. Israeli undercover troops hiding in a van loaded with vegetables assassinated a top Hamas leader in a roadside ambush yesterday in Gaza. Another group of soldiers shot dead two Palestinians and blew up a house of a suspected Hamas member. A total of 14 Palestinians have been killed since Sunday. Over the weekend in Gaza, four Israeli soldiers were killed when their tank was bombed, and the Israeli daily Haaretz is reporting that Israeli troops are poised for a major strike in Gaza. The U.S. government has quietly barred two Saudi Arabian Airlines pilots from flying in the United States on the grounds that they pose a security threat. Under a new aviation law, the government can now strip any pilot of their license without providing evidence of wrongdoing. And an Iraqi journalist who covers United Nations for the official Iraqi news agency has been expelled from the United States. The government is claiming he is harmful to national security.
Would you harbor me? Would I harbor you? Would you harbor me? Would I harbor you? Would you harbor a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a heretic, convict, or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a person? fugitive or a slave? Would you harbor a Haitian Glorian or Czech, a lesbian or a gay? Would you harbor a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a heretic, convict, or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a person living within?
Sweet honey in the rock, would you harbor me? You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today, a Democracy Now! Exclusive. It's a story about a respected Greek mathematics professor who was invited to the United States to address a conference at New York University. When he arrived at John Kennedy Airport, he didn't expect the greeting that he got. He was detained by the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And, well, he'll tell the rest. This is Professor Eugene Angelopoulos of Athens Technical University, who walked into our studios Friday rather stunned after his ordeal.
My name is Eugene Angelopoulos, and I came in New York representing my university. I'm a university professor, so I came here to attend a conference in the New York University. When I arrived, they told me to follow the man at the immigration office, some official.
Kennedy Airport?
At JFK, yeah. And then I had five hours, I believe, that were not very good as a welcome. So what happened during these 5 hours? They put me handcuffs like that in the hands in, on the belt and cuffed together. I said I refuse because if I am to be cuffed, I want to know the charges against me. They said there are no charges against you, it's just the rules. The rules, I said, I have no problem of following you. They said it's the rules, so it's not personal, do not take it personal. So I said, I will not obey. I will not be cooperating with you. You have to use violence on me and put me the handcuffs by force. I will not resist, but I will not help you putting the handcuffs for me. So they took one hand, they put it, the other hand they put it, and like that I was to, well.
At any point did you ask to speak to a lawyer?
They told me that I was not in the United States territory officially, so I was not under the benefit of the law. They took me off the handcuffs and they put chains on my feet. She asked me if I was ever been arrested. I said yes. She said, on what charge? I said, I don't know. She said, when? I said, now. She said, but now you're not arrested. And I replied, what am I? And then she said, are you anti-American? And I said, what? Are you anti-American? What does it mean? I did not understand. If you, I said, I am against, for instance, the American policy in war. I don't want war to happen, as many Americans do, as many people do in the world. But is this being anti-American? I don't think it is anti-American. And I told her that it is against America's own interests to do the war again on Iraq. And that was of course a political issue. And then she wrote down he's against war on Iraq and said, are you going to report that? To put that on your report? Is all that All this thing is about my opinion of the war on Iraq? I can't believe it. And then she passed to the other question, what do you know about the 17th of November?
Can you say anything about November 17th group to give people in this country who's never heard of it a sense of what it's about and how it fits into the politics of Greece?
Well, this is a group of, say, terrorists, though I don't like this word, which has killed 27 people in 27 years and pretending to bring true socialism or... these people who killed were either politicians or American secret agents or military men from Greece and other countries or rich people or, I don't know, some representatives of the higher class. And one by one, they started bringing people to jail. I have the feeling, no, I'm not the only one, that the sentences of this of the trial which is going to be held are already given in the sense that the trial has gone on the gone over on the TV before it enters the court, and most people are convinced that all these people are guilty. Even some of them claim their innocence, and some of them say they are guilty. So. I think that my country also has to protect human rights, and my country also has to provide a fair trial for people who are accused. There is a man who I knew when we were both students in France during the 60s, and who claims to be innocent, and the FBI asked me about him. I said I knew him. I never denied that I knew him, and I'm going to testify in his trial because I think he, since he says he's innocent, I think he's innocent, even if though I have not seen him for many years.
What is his name?
His name is Yotopoulos. He is accused of being the chief of the of this organization, and I believe he's framed. Why should they treat me like a terrorist, since they know very well I am not a terrorist? This would create a diplomatic incident, so I am confident that reason will prevail in the FBI and the other services. And if it does not, well, it's not of my fault. But I still believe the United States still has some democratic feelings, and if these people do something like that to me, this will be going against their inner credo. And so I'm confident also in human nature. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I hope I'm right.
Professor Angelopoulos agreed to the FBI's request for a second interview on condition it be held at New York University, where he was attending the conference thinking it was neutral ground. When he returned to his hotel after leaving Democracy Now! Last Friday, he had a phone message from the FBI saying that they preferred not to go to New York University, but that after the conference on Saturday, he should come to the FBI's offices for a, quote, uninterrupted conversation with them. Professor Angelopoulos called the Greek consulate. They contacted the FBI and said he would not be coming to that interview. I caught up with Professor Angelopoulos again as he was leaving the country. He went to the Greek consulate, the consul general was going to accompany him to the airport on Sunday night. We talked in the car.
Since we last spoke on Friday, I had already heard to my consulate and to my university, and there was a protest of the Greek government in the American embassy in Athens, and I am now under the protection of the consular authorities of Greece. I still think America is a big democratic country, and hopes of all the world is rely on the American people action to because, the demonstration all over the world against the war was yesterday. I think we can all live in peace, and I think democracy will prevail at the end. Thank you.
Professor Eugene Angelopoulos made it to the airport and ended up flying out on the last plane before the blizzard shut down John Kennedy Airport to Paris. At the conference on Saturday, he read some of the words he had written while he was being held in detention and was shackled. He read it, his opening remarks for the conference, Philosophy as Politics. He said, "Today, U.S. troops are preparing to invade Iraq while lots of U.S. citizens demonstrate their opposition to war. Today, the leading democracy of the world is the United States. Contradiction is inherent to democracy, and every time one term of the contradiction prevails. I don't know if this is a fight between good and evil. This is for this assembly of philosophers to debate. But it is good for the world to know that America has many choices and voices, and not only the one of her president. Hope is not dead, and I am sure this conference will help keep hope alive." Outside the conference, about 20 blocks up, between 500,000 and 1,000,000 people were protesting, joining tens of millions of people around the world saying no to war. And before we leave this segment, we're joined now by Leslie Kagan, who is the coordinator of the mass protest in New York, also chair of the Pacifica, of the board of the Pacifica Foundation. Welcome, Leslie.
Hi, it's good to be here. My voice isn't quite back yet, but it is getting stronger again.
Well, we're talking about the INS and FBI tactics. Ironically enough, the same day that the protest was taking place in New York, as you reflect on what happened, you're also going to be holding a news conference, because what wasn't told, though we heard voices around the world saying no to war, was what happened to hundreds of protesters in New York.
Yes, the day was wonderful here in New York and around the world, but there were problems that were created totally by the New York City Police Department. I don't even have the exact numbers yet, but upwards 300 people were arrested here in New York. Most of them, the overwhelming majority, were arrested simply because they were trying to get to the rally site, and the New York City Police Department did not let peaceful demonstrators flow north on 2nd Avenue to then go over to 1st Avenue. We had been promised by the police that people could fill in on 1st Avenue as far north as they needed to, and yet they were stopping peaceful protesters from getting over to 1st Avenue. And just the bottleneck of people, the crush of people, did lead to some confrontations and some difficulties with the police. But above that, above and beyond that, the way the police handled those arrests is completely outrageous and unacceptable. There was definitely excessive force used. Several times horses were brought in, trampling several people. I didn't witness this myself, but people who I know and trust saw people stepped on by horses. At the same time, after people were arrested, the treatment that they got by the New York City Police Department was outrageous. Several people, for instance, were shackled outside of one police plaza, not on a bus, not in a van, but outside the building into the wee hours of the morning on that very, very cold night, not having access to food or bathrooms. Finally, they were processed. But the fact that anybody got arrested, the way those arrests happened, and then the treatment of people after they were arrested is totally unacceptable here in New York, or actually anywhere in the country, or for that matter, anywhere in the world.
In Colorado Springs on Saturday, anti-war protesters now blasting local police for using riot gear, tear gas, and rubber bullets to disperse participants at a peace demonstration as it was winding down. But according to a report in today's Denver Post, police maintain the response was appropriate. We're going to hear a brief report from one protester who was tear gassed and arrested. This is Bob Schoflett.
Police lined up on the perimeter of the parking lot and completely unprovoked began shooting tear gas. Some people were getting into their cars, other, you know, families were moving along into the park. It just became really chaotic. A lot of people were just kind of running out of the park into the neighborhood, which is adjacent to the parking lot area. At that point, the police started shooting rubber bullets. A couple of newspaper accounts said There was one rubber bullet shot, but I clearly saw about five or six rubber bullets shot. I didn't see where they hit, but I did hear a report that at least one person was shot with a rubber bullet and then hit with a taser or stun gun. At that point, while I was essentially trying to help some people out of the park, the police, one of the riot police units, moved toward my affinity group. One officer just sprinted from about 50 yards at me, grabbed me and tackled me, and then another three or four officers tackled one of my affinity group partners, and they had a canine unit with them and all these other things. So we wound up getting arrested for failure to disperse from a public park.
Bob Schoflett of Colorado Springs, you're nodding your head, Leslie.
Yeah, this is, I mean, it's outrageous that it happened. It's certainly not the first time that police in many parts of the country have behaved like this. What we need to do, obviously, is organize to make sure it's the last time. I have heard reports, and we'll be looking at footage later, and we'll show it at the press conference, of the New York City Police Department using pepper spray on people in New York City, in the streets of New York. Again, people had assembled for a peaceful protest.
Mm-hmm. Finally, you organized the 1982 major anti-nuclear march in Central Park, more than a million people there. How do you compare the police tactics now? We didn't even discuss how people were penned in.
Yes.
And how hard it was to get an estimate of the numbers because of how many tens of thousands of people, 1st, 2nd Avenue, riot police, as well as mounted police.
Yes, I think the New York City Police Department and the mayor's office have really fine-tune the art of separating demonstrators by using these pens, police barricades, metal police barricades, where it's very difficult to get in or out, and really very consciously separating people, thereby, I think, making us look smaller than we really are. The incredible thing about, and none of that happened 20 years ago. It really started during the Giuliani administration here in New York, but Mayor Bloomberg has taken it to a new level of really using these tactics to try and undermine the power of the demonstration. The good news is that people didn't let that happen, and there were really hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people on the streets of New York making their opposition to this war heard, regardless of pens and police tactics.
Do you have any final thought or on the number, any final count?
Well, it's virtually impossible to know. I believe it was at least 500,000, and it may have been more. I know there are people who never even made it over to the east side of New York. The important story here, though, is that all around the country and all around the world, literally millions of people were on the streets making their opposition known.
Leslie Kagan, she was the coordinator of the anti-war march in New York. Thank you very much for coming in. I know it took you an hour and a half to get here. New York is completely snowed in, and most people are staying home. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, Noam Chomsky.
The kids are marching with the guard in the Marcy public house in yards, and they don't mind killing a few good children a day. Drop the jump count, 1 and 2, 3, 4, and it's here we go, another war. Let's hit our targets and keep our markets in shape.
Revolution number 2 by The What, here on Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. This from Newsweek: Turkey's raising its price for allowing U.S. forces to invade Iraq from its territory. In early negotiations with the United States, Ankara spoke of sending in Turkish troops to set up a buffer zone, perhaps 15 miles deep along the Iraqi border. This would prevent a flood of Kurdish refugees from northern Iraq, the Turks said. But now Newsweek has learned Turkey is demanding that it send 60,000 to 80,000 of its own troops and to northern Iraq to establish, quote, strategic positions across a security arc as much as 140 to 170 miles deep in Iraq. That would take Turkish troops almost halfway to Baghdad. These troops would not be under U.S. command, according to Turkish sources, who say Turkey has agreed only to coordination between U.S. and Turkish forces. Ankara fears the Iraqi Kurds might use Saddam's fall to declare independence. Kurdish leaders have not yet been told of this new plan, according to the Kurdish spokesman in Washington, who say the Kurds rejected even the earlier notion of a narrow buffer zone. Farhad Barzani, the U.S. representative of the main Kurdish party in Iraq, the KDP, says, "We have told them American troops will come as liberators, but Turkish troops will be seen as invaders." This from the latest Newsweek, an exclusive. Well, talking about Turkey, it's an issue that Noam Chomsky took on as well. Noam Chomsky was speaking at the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil, over the last few weeks. He was speaking alongside Arundhati Roy, the great Indian writer. He spoke in a stadium of more than 10,000 people. This is some of what he had to say.
We're meeting at a moment of world history that is in many ways unique. It's a moment that is ominous, but it's also full of hope. The most powerful state in world history has proclaimed loud and clear that it intends to rule the world by force. That is the dimension in which it reigns supreme. The war in Iraq will teach some lessons about what lies ahead when the empire decides to strike a blow. That's surely one of the main reasons for the war. The empire has also declared explicitly and precisely that it will tolerate no competitors now or in the future. Its leaders believe that the means of violence in their hands are so extraordinary that they can dismiss with contempt anyone who stands in their way. That doctrine is by no means new, but it has never before been proclaimed with such brazen arrogance, at least not by I should add, at least not by anyone who we would care to remember. I won't jar your memories. I'm not going to try to answer the question that was posed for this meeting, the question of how to confront the empire. The reason is that most of you know the answers as well or better than I do from your own work and your own lives. The way to confront the empire is to create a world, a different world, one that is not based on violence and subjugation, on hate and fear. That's why we are here. The World Social Forum offers the hope that these are not idle dreams, and this is also for the first time in history. Yesterday, I had the rare privilege of seeing some of the most inspiring work that is being done to achieve these goals. I was able to spend some hours at the international gathering of Via Campesina at a farm community established by the MST, which I think is the most important and exciting popular movement in the world, and one of the main reasons One of the main reasons why the World Social Forum is in Brazil and not in the United States or England or somewhere else. With constructive local actions of the kind that the MST has been pioneering for many years, and with international organizations like the Via Campesina and the World Social Forum, with sympathy and solidarity and mutual aid, there is real hope for a decent future. I've also had some other experiences in the past few months which give an idea of what the world will be like if imperial violence is not limited and dismantled. Last month, I was in Turkey, including southeastern Turkey, the Kurdish areas. This is the scene of some of the worst atrocities of the 1990s. They are still continuing, just as in Bolivia. I was just informed this morning by a friend, a visitor from the Kurdish Human Rights Association, that last week the military forces carried out major atrocities at a town just a few kilometers from the city that I visited last month, murdered a dozen people, left the corpses, mutilated corpses very visibly in the streets to terrorize everyone else. Happens to be a town that was destroyed by the military in the last few years, but a few people remain and they have to be terrorized. This campaign of state terror drove literally millions of people out of the devastated countryside. Tens of thousands were killed. The Kurdish Human Rights Association estimates about 50,000, 3 million expelled or fled. Those who survive you can find them. I visited some in condemned buildings in miserable slums in Istanbul or outside the walls of the cities to which they have fled. 80% of the arms for these atrocities came from the United States, increasing as the atrocities escalated through the 1990s. In the single year 1997, the Clinton administration sent more arms to Turkey than in the entire Cold War period combined up to the onset of the state terror campaign. Turkey actually became the leading recipient in the world of U.S. arms. That's excluding Israel and Egypt, which are a separate category. In 1999, Turkey relinquished this position as the leading recipient of U.S. arms and handed it over to Colombia. The reason is that in Turkey, U.S.-backed state terror had succeeded at a horrendous cost. In Colombia, it had not yet succeeded. Colombia is the leading human rights violator in the hemisphere, has been for the last 10 years. It has also been the leading recipient of U.S. arms in the hemisphere, actually more than the rest of Latin America combined, and it now leads the world. It leads the world by other measures, too. For example, it leads the world in murder of labor activists. And more than half of the labor activists killed in the world in the last decade have been killed in Colombia. Last year, close to 500,000 people were driven off the land. That's a new record. The number of displaced people driven off the land in Colombia is now more than 2.5 million. Last year, 20 people were killed every day in political violence. That's double the number of 5 years ago. I was also there a few months ago. I visited Cauca in southern Colombia. That's the province that has the worst human rights record in Colombia, which is quite an achievement. There I spent hours listening to testimonies by peasants who were driven off the land by chemical warfare, what's called fumigation. Their lives and lands are destroyed, their children are dying, they're sick and wounded, the effects of chemical war. Peasant agriculture, as you all know, is based on a very rich tradition of knowledge and experience gained over hundreds of years, often millennia, usually handed down by mothers to daughters. It's a rich, successful, one of the great human achievements, but it's extremely fragile. It can be destroyed in a single generation, which is what is happening consciously. Also being destroyed is some of the richest biodiversity in the world, very much like nearby regions of Brazil. The campesinos, the indigenous people, Afro-Colombians, can join the millions of people who are somehow surviving in rotting urban slums and camps. With the people driven out, multinational corporations can come in, strip the mountains for coal, extract oil and other resources, convert what is left of the land to agro-export run by multinationals using laboratory-produced seeds. The scenes that I personally just happened to see in Cauca and southern Turkey are very different from the celebrations of the Via Campesino gathering at the MST community. But Turkey and Colombia also provide very inspiring and hopeful lessons in different ways. Because of the indescribable courage and dedication of people who are struggling for justice and freedom, confronting the empire just where it is killing and torturing and destroying. These are signs of the future if the empire proceeds on its normal course. Remember that this is before it declared the grand strategy of global rule by force. It's not inevitable, and there are some very good models for ending these atrocities, including the MST, the Via Campesina, the World Social Forum. But they have to be developed and built. The range of issues and problems that are coming up at the World Social Forum is very broad, remarkably so. I think we can identify two major themes. One is global justice and life after capitalism, or to put it more simply, life, because it is not so clear that the species can survive. That is literally true. It's not clear that the species can survive very long under existing state capitalist institutions. The second theme is related. It's the theme of war and peace. More specifically, the war in Iraq that the United States and Britain are desperately trying to carry out virtually alone, in part to teach the lessons that I just mentioned. Well, let me start talking about this with some of the good news about these basic themes. As you know, there's a conference going on right now of the World Economic Forum in Davos. Here in Porto Alegre, the mood is like at the Via Campesina meeting yesterday, hopeful, vigorous, exciting. In Davos, so the press tells us, quoting it, the mood has darkened. It is not global party time anymore. In fact, Davos and Porto Alegre are correlated. As the mood and the participation here grows, the mood there darkens and becomes more gloomy, and for good reasons. In fact, the founder of the World Economic Forum has just conceded defeat. He said, "The power of corporations has completely disappeared." Okay. So we've won. There's nothing left for us to do but to pick up the pieces, not only talk about a vision of the future that is just and humane, but move on to create life after capitalism. Of course, we know enough to understand that we should not let the praise go to our heads. There's still a few difficulties ahead. The main theme of the World Economic Forum is building trust, and there's a reason for that. The masters of the universe, as they like to call themselves, know that they are in serious trouble. The World Economic Forum recently released a poll showing that trust in leaders had severely declined. Only leaders of non-governmental organizations, NGOs, only they had the trust of a majority of the population in the world. They were followed by the United Nations and religious leaders, then going way down, leaders of Western Europe, well below them, corporate executives, and finally, at the very bottom, leaders of the United States with about 25% trust. 25% trust means essentially zero. For a good reason. When people are asked, "Do you trust leaders?" usually they say yes, just out of habit. So if 25% acted out of habit, that means it's essentially nothing. It actually gets worse. A few days ago, a poll in Canada found that over a third of the population regard the United States as the greatest threat to world peace. The United States ranks more than twice as high as Iraq or North Korea, far higher than Al-Qaeda. A less scientific poll by Time magazine found that over 80% of respondents regarded the United States as the greatest threat to world peace, compared with less than 10% for Iraq or North Korea. Without going on, the corporate leaders who paid $30,000 each to attend the somber meetings in Davos have good reasons to take as their theme building trust.
You are listening to Noam Chomsky. He's speaking in Porto Alegre, Brazil, at the World Social Forum to a crowd of more than 10,000 people in a stadium. We'll be back with him in just a moment.
Though we are told to mourn it, we must know that it was a noble sound. As we gather here to mourn the passing of this noble sound, we should take the pains to remember something. There are some of us who don't accept the dreams of dragons as their own, no matter how grand those dragons might say they are. Yes, there are some who will refuse to drop the candle even when pushed into a dark cave and locked there behind a stone. There is, you must recall, a kind of serious study that will give you the confidence to strike your match to the mighty wick that will illuminate yet another portion of the darkness.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, as we return to Noam Chomsky in Porto Alegre, Brazil.
It's rather striking that strong opposition to the coming war extends right through the establishment. So the current issues of the two major foreign policy journals feature articles opposing the war by leading figures of foreign policy elites. The very respectable American Academy of Arts and Sciences released a long monograph on the war, trying to give the most sympathetic possible account of the Bush administration position and then dismantling it point by point. One respected analyst they quote is a senior associate of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, who warns that the United States is becoming a menace to itself and to mankind under its current leadership. There are no precedents for anything like this, and they show very clearly how isolated the leadership of the United States and Britain are in the world, even in their own countries. We should recognize that these criticisms from the establishment are very narrow. They are concerned with threats to the United States. They do not take into account the likely effect of a war on Iraqis. The warnings of the United Nations and aid agencies that millions of people will be at very serious risk, that in a country that is at the edge of survival, after a terrible war that targeted its basic infrastructure, which amounts to biological warfare, and a decade of devastating sanctions that have killed hundreds of thousands of people and blocked any reconstruction while strengthening the brutal tyrant who rules Iraq. Nevertheless, the threats that do concern the establishment critics are very real. They were not surprised when the CIA informed Congress last October that they know of no link between Iraq and Al-Qaeda-style terrorism, but that an attack on Iraq would create such links. It would probably increase the terrorist threat to the West in many ways. They pointed out that it is likely to inspire a new generation of terrorists bent on revenge, and it might induce Iraq to carry out terrorist attacks that are already in place. That's a possibility taken very seriously by high-level U.S. analysts. A high-level task force of the Council on Foreign Relations just released a report warning of likely terrorist attacks that will be far worse than September 11th, dangers, they say, that become much more urgent by the prospect of the U.S. going to war with Iraq. That includes the possible use of weapons of mass destruction right within the United States. And they provide many illustrations. Actually, if you read it, it's virtually a cookbook for terrorists. And it's not the first. Similar ones were published by prominent strategic analysts long before September 11th. It's also understood that an attack on Iraq may lead not just to more terror, but also to proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, which means a serious threat to human survival, and for a very simple reason. Potential targets of the United States understand that there is no other way to deter the most powerful state in history, a state which is pursuing America's imperial ambition. Happens to be a title of an article in the main establishment journal, Foreign Affairs, warning of the dangers to the United States and to the world of the grand strategy that was proclaimed by the Bush administration last September, ruling the world by force. Prominent hawks now warn that a war in Iraq might lead to the greatest proliferation disaster in history. They know that if Iraq has chemical and biological weapons, the dictatorship keeps them under tight control and would not use them except as a last resort if it's attacked, and would surely not leak them to the Osama bin Ladens of the world, because that would be a terrible threat to Saddam Hussein himself. But under attack, the society would collapse, including the controls over weapons of mass destruction. The hawks, I'm quoting, tell us these would be privatized and offered to the huge market for unconventional weapons, where they will have no trouble finding buyers, and that will be a nightmare scenario, the hawks warn, for all of us. Even before the Bush administration began beating the war drums about Iraq, there were plenty of warnings that its adventurism was going to lead to proliferation of weapons of mass destruction as well as terror, simply as a deterrent. In fact, right now, the United States is teaching the world a very ugly and dangerous lesson. If you want to defend yourself from us, you had better mimic North Korea and pose a credible military threat, including weapons of mass destruction. Otherwise, we will demolish you in pursuit of the new grand strategy, which really is remarkable. Not entirely new, but an unusually brazen proclamation that the U.S. will rule the world by force and tolerate no possible competitors or opposition. That has caused plenty of shudders, not only among the usual victims, the great majority of the people of the world, and in old Europe, but right at the heart of the U.S. foreign policy elite, who recognize, I'm quoting, that the commitment of the United States to active military confrontation for decisive national advantage will leave the world more dangerous and the U.S. less secure. That's the foreign policy elite in their own journals. The timing of this propaganda campaign is also very instructive. It was so transparent that it also has been a topic of discussion and sometimes ridicule right in the mainstream. The campaign began last September. Before that, Saddam was a terrible guy, but not a threat to the survival of the United States. The mushroom cloud was announced in early September, and since that time, fear of that Saddam will attack the United States has been running at about 60 to 70% of the population. There's nothing remotely like that anywhere else in the world. This is so obvious that mainstream commentators are ridiculing it. the chief political analyst of United Press International, commenting on this, wrote that September marked the opening of the political campaign for the midterm congressional elections. As he put it, the administration was campaigning to sustain and increase its power on a policy of international interventionism, new radical preemptive military strategies, and a hunger for a politically convenient and perfectly timed confrontation with Iraq. As long as domestic issues were in the forefront, Bush and his cohorts were losing ground, which is very natural, because they're carrying out a serious assault against the general population. But he continues, although there were no new threats since the beginning of September, national security issues moved into the driver's seat, not just Al-Qaeda, but an awesome and threatening military power, Iraq. Those same observations have been made for many others. That's actually quite convenient for people like us. We can just quote the mainstream instead of giving controversial analyses. The Carnegie Endowment senior associate who I quoted before writes that Bush and company are following the classic modern strategy of an endangered right-wing oligarchy, which is to divert mass discontent into nationalism inspired by fear of enemies about to destroy us. And that strategy is of critical importance if the radical nationalists setting policy in Washington hope to advance their announced plan for unilateral world domination through absolute military superiority while conducting a major assault against the interests of the majority of the domestic population. For the election, the strategy worked, barely. The fall 2000 election was won by a small number of votes, but enough to hand Congress to the executive. Now, there have been careful analyses of the election since. They found that voters maintained their opposition to the Bush administration on social and economic issues, but suppressed these concerns in favor of security concerns, which typically lead to support for the figure in authority, the brave cowboy who has to ride to our rescue. As history shows,
that is Noam Chomsky speaking in Porto Alegre, Brazil, at the World Social Forum before more than 10,000 people in the stadium. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Andrew Caron, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.